If you've got the notes, you'll notice it says, when life gets messy. Going to show you, before I get too far into my intro, we're going to be looking at Paul's journey. Started off down in Jerusalem. After they'd arrived, he'd arrived in Jerusalem, and he'd been told he'd have a wonderful time there. You remember that? How all the prophets said he was going to have a great time while being carried around and knocked around. And eventually he ended up at Caesarea after they'd tried plots against him and all that kind of stuff. And from the sunny coast of Caesarea, he then took a cruise up to Sidon and worked his way around this way. Now, if you look at the scale here, that's 500 miles from here to here. You can see that's about 500 miles here, 500. A lot of territory to cover. And the prevailing weather is westerlies coming across in this direction, blowing this way. So that'll help us to understand the sort of trouble that they were having as they were travelling, trying to go that way. The wind apparently goes around like this. So if they start down in Alexandria, down in Egypt, you've got only a two-week trip that way because the wind just help carry you along, especially during the summer. But anyway, that's the motion of the winds. So when life gets hard, when it gets messy, we tend to ask three questions about God. Three questions. Is God in control? Does he care? And why? Why? What's his purpose in all that's happening? Now, each of you have had, or will have, some messy times in your life. As you know, life's been challenging for us in the years gone by in losing Philip. He got cancer at age 12. We were playing cricket out on the front lawn, and he said, "Daddy, I've got my leg's sore." And we found out he had a cancer in his leg. And he had to have that leg chopped off. But then they did an operation where they could turn the lower leg round, joint it onto the upper, and his ankle became his knee. And so he could then wear a prosthesis. So I could still play table tennis with him, and he could rock back and forward on his prosthesis. And Ben used to, they used to have a game when he'd have this club or a stick, and Ben would have the stick and go whack against Ben's prosthesis. He was wearing long pants, and everybody else was like, oh, gasp. You can have fun when things are tough, but it's still tough. Life gets messy. Who's in charge? Is God actually really, truly in charge? Does he care? And does he have a purpose? Well, there are three questions we're going to look at today as we're going to actually work through the narrative. And because it is a story, we may as well stick with the story. So let's go. Paul had his rough trot, and as promised, he arrived in Jerusalem. Remember all the prophecies that God had given him saying it's going to be tough? Well, that was just to toughen Paul up so he'd be ready for when the tough times came. It wasn't to stop him going to Jerusalem. It was so he wouldn't expect a lovely time when he got there. So God was actually preparing him for the lovely time, well, not so lovely time he was going to have in Jerusalem. And then after he'd testified in Jerusalem, the Lord appeared to him, and says in 23:11, that and appeared to him and said, as you have testified here, so you will also testify in Rome. So he's got this promise in the back of his head, I'm going to get to Rome. And since the Jews were out to get Paul by any means, fair or foul, and since Paul was a Roman citizen, he appealed to Caesar. And so off to Caesar he was going. Off to Rome he headed. So if you follow the text with me in 27:1, and when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. You'll notice some Roman organization operating in this passage right through. So people are in charge. And we find out that this centurion is actually higher, has got more authority than the captain of the ship. He ends up running things. He obviously had quite a few stripes on his arm. Now, verse 2, embarking in a ship of Adramyttium, that's where the ship comes from, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, going north, we put to sea. You can imagine the seagulls swinging across the sky and all the sailors in the ship and the noise and the smell of the salt sea air, and off they were going. It's about August, apparently, when they were heading off, sort of into their autumn in the Northern Hemisphere. We put to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. Now, it is we put to sea. Luke is speaking, because Luke is on board too. So Paul's got these two, and as it turns out, they would be treated as Paul's servants. He's a Roman citizen. He's gone to stand up for his rights in Rome to appeal to Caesar. And the centurion knew that, and it would be quite appropriate for Paul to have a couple of servants tagging along. You know, if you were tried to come as a relative, you weren't allowed to go. But servants was fine. So, verse 3, the next day we put in at Sidon. Things going nicely so far. And Julius treated Paul kindly. Obviously, this Roman citizen named Paul had a good way with people in authority. He didn't, he wasn't just another one of the ordinary prisoners. This was somebody special, and Julius treated him as such and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for, so he could shoot off into town with his friends and the centurion wouldn't worry that he was going to lose a prisoner. Precisely because Paul, in fact, wanted to go to Rome, so he wasn't going to disappear into the woodwork. So, verse 4, and putting out to sea again, this time from Sidon, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus. Now, under the lee means into the wind shadow. Wind's going that way. Instead of going across here, they come around that way to hide from the westerly wind. So they went under the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. Now, you can see that word against and difficulties, you can see this isn't the cruise that they were necessarily bargaining on. Things weren't going as swimmingly as you might have hoped. Verse 5, and when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia, if you look at the map, going now westward, along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra in Lycia. So they covered about 500 miles. They, being close to shore, would help them avoid that westerly wind. And also they could take advantage of the currents. And that's where they had a ship change. The centurion found a ship of Alexandria. That's from down in Egypt, apparently going around the other way, not taking the shortcut. Which was sailing for Italy, and put us on board. Now, just so you get an idea of the ship, they were up to 3,000 tons, these ships, not made of steel, obviously. They're wood ships, and the width of them, they're 15 metres, roughly up to 15 metres across. Now, this room's 9 metres. Or 10 metres. So you've got to add it to this room another half, and you get a feel of how wide the ship is. And almost twice as long as this room. Get a feel for it. Got decks below. You got all the wheat and stuff down below. So, and you've got to fit 200, they can take up to 600 passengers. This particular one had cargo plus 276 passengers. Well, how was the cruise going? Well, just before I go on, the reason this ship was probably part of a fleet that fed Rome. All the wheat, most of the wheat grew down in Egypt. And so you get this this fleet of ships that would be feeding the hungries in Italy. And Italy being in charge, they would organise. And if you were the leader of the country, as long as you can keep the tummies full, you're doing a good thing. So you work hard and having a good fleet of incoming food. And this ship was one of those, or at least most likely to be, but it was certainly headed for Rome with wheat. Verse 7, we sailed slowly, not a good sign, for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus. And as the wind did not allow us to go, as it were, further west, we sailed down, they went and hid under the lee of Crete, of Salmone. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which is the city of Lycia. And this is where a bit of drama happens. Was it the pleasure trip that they'd expected? Well, actually, they were. The weather was going to be getting tougher for them. They're in the way, since they're going in autumn, autumn's starting to get dangerous. If you're sailing, they generally stop sailing from mid-September. Now, they would have started in August, but they, by this time, we're getting into September. In fact, they've gone past it. They've gone so slowly. They definitely don't want to be on the water halfway through November. So, how are they going for time? Because you can imagine you're under pressure of time to get this wheat to Rome. Verse 9, since much time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous because even the fast was over. This is one of the fasts of the Jews. The date, if it was AD 59 going into 60, it would have been October the 5th was when the fast. And October the 5th had already passed. So they're well into October. And it's not very far from November. And Paul can see this is not a good thing. So he says, Paul advised them saying, sirs, notice the plural there. He's talking to a group, probably not dissimilar to this. Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also our lives. So they're having this kind of a council discussing their options. Now, you can imagine the pilot and the owner, they'd be under pressure, wouldn't they? We've got to get this cargo. This isn't a really good port in Fair Havens. It would be nice if we can get to the next one along. There's probably some money involved and maybe a few other motives. But Paul comes in, and in Proverbs it says, a prudent man, this is Proverbs 22, verse 3, a prudent man sees danger and hides himself. But the simple go on and suffer for it. We're wise when we can see a danger and we hide. That's not silly. That's just common sense. So Paul's applying that principle right here. He sees danger and says, let's hide. But, verse 11, the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and the owner of the ship than what Paul said. And as a centurion, he's the one in charge. And whose advice does he take? Well, these other two. Because he doesn't know Paul that well. And besides, he's just just another bod. Verse 12. Another reason here. And because the harbour was not suitable to spend the winter in, either perhaps for the ship, it might have survived okay, but it mightn't be very suitable, and not very nice to actually stay as a place, the majority decided to put out to sea from there. Notice their method. On the chance that. You like doing things by chance? You know, the tyres are they're only half full, but, you know, I need to get them pumped up. But look, I won't stop at this service station because I'm running a bit short of time, or we'll keep going on the chance. So this is risk taking, isn't it? That's what they're doing, taking risks. On the chance that somehow they should reach Phoenix, a much better place, a harbour of Crete with a couple of different aspects. So they weighed their options. They were taking a calculated risk. under pressure. Now, is the Lord in charge? Is God in charge? Yep. It's a messy situation. Yep. Can Paul do anything about it? No. Is it the mercy of the people's whims? Were you anxious? It's fair enough to be anxious in that sort of situation. But so, you know, the clincher on their decision making is they look for an omen. We all do that, don't we? We shouldn't. We're looking for omens. No, but they do. Verse 13, now when the south wind blew gently, oh, how nice, lulled in. They're going to take this huge risk, and they've got this little, it's a bit sunny at the moment. When the south wind blew gently, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete, keeping close to the shore. Why do you think they kept close to the shore? Well, you know, if all else, you know. Well, there's a big word here called but. And this is the big but for them. But soon a tempestuous wind. We actually get our word typhoon from the Greek here, that's used for this word. But soon a typhoon wind called the Northeaster. So obviously it had been around before. They just like we've got in Perth, they call it the doctor, don't they? Comes in at the same time. Well, this one, it comes occasionally, but boy, when it comes, it's struck down from the land. And when the ship is actually caught by it. Imagine a ship twice the length of this room, half again as wide, and it's caught by this wind. It couldn't face it. We gave way and went to it and were driven along, out of control. Can you imagine the centurion? If only. You know, was that the right decision we made? You can. Paul's view, is the Lord in charge? Yep, Lord's still in charge. So what happens next? What can they do? When you're in a tough situation, you do everything possible you can to maximize your chances of survival. So what do? Running under the lee of a small island called Corda, the wind's blowing them down, and they manage to get a little bit of a break, not a very big one. We managed with difficulty. Now, the we there, that Luke imagined him pulling on the rope to secure the ship's boat, because they had this boat that they towed along so that when you come into a port, the captain could get down or people could get down and go into shore. You could just anchor off the coast somewhere. But this boat was now anchored as an anchor. You can imagine being filled with water, the waves sloshing into it, and it would have just been this towing, pulling them down. So they drag this thing up into the ship with difficulty, and after hoisting them aboard, they then used supports to undergird the ship. Now, the sort of things they did was they wrapped ropes, had some method of getting ropes around the ship to try and hold it together. Now, you imagine this, the forces involved. You've got a mast or a couple of masts that are being bent this way or this way, and all the forces and the leverage and the timbers down here going, you know, try and support that as much as you can. So they use the ropes to try and hold the boat together. Can you imagine the boat would be leaking a bit too? So, but that was not all their fears. Then, fearing that they would run on the Sistus, this area down there. That area down there was known for its quicksand and as a ship's graveyard. So, not a happy place to end up. So they're afraid of ending up down there. They lowered the gear to sort of cut back the sail. Finally, that they had a chance to do, cut back the sail. And so they were driven along. Afraid? Absolutely. Well, what could they do? Anything else? Verse 18, since we were violently torn. Can you imagine the huge seas? Just massive waves, mountainous waves. they began the next day to chuck the cargo overboard. And on the third day, they were throwing overboard the ship's tackle, stuff that helped to run the ship, and they did it with their own hands. They're getting to be desperate, aren't they? See, it's just building up, isn't it? And verse 20 really brings it home. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, what's the significance of that? No sun or stars. How do you steer a ship? By the sun and the stars. You know which way is which. It's like being in a fog. I operate by the sun. When I went to over to America one time, the sun was in the wrong quadrant. It was, and my left hand became my right hand. I was all mixed up. But if it's just fog, lost. They didn't have any way to have bearings. And they were just going, knowing not where they were going. And you do that for 2 weeks, how do you feel? And the weather's still awful. All hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. Can you imagine how desperately low that is? You are at the rock's bottom. And God always has his timing just right. The situation's hopeless. No bearings. Is God in control? Yep, let's see. Since they've been without food, or kind of verse 21, without food for a long time, you probably would have had trouble keeping it down anyway, and just being plain scared is enough to kill the appetite, and fasting perhaps, you know, to try and get God on side. Paul stood up among them and said, can you imagine him doing that, standing up? And this is what he said. Just picture it. Men, you should have listened to me and not set sail from Crete and incurred the injury and loss. Now, that's all he said. That would be not a good look, would it? What's he doing? Is he trying to rub guilt in? Actually, no, he's not. What he's doing is trying to help them to see that what he's about to say is coming from somebody who knows what he is saying. He was right then, and he's going to be right now. So he's actually working on giving them hope. Although it sounds very negative, he's working on giving them hope, because he goes on to say, yet, very big word, verse 22, yet now I urge you to take heart, be encouraged. For there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night, right that night, when everything is at rock bottom, except them, this very night, there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship. Wow. He's very careful to speak their language, isn't he? He didn't say Yahweh, or he said, the God to whom I belong. Isn't that a lovely phrase? I belong to God. So if he belongs to God, who's going to be looking after him? God is. Isn't that lovely? So God's looking after his belongings and whom I worship. Appropriate response. So this very night, an angel, actually, did anybody see the angel running up to how did the angel get there? We don't tend to think of angels being around, do we? Angels in the middle of some ocean somewhere. How'd they get there? No problems to God. Not limited by the way we think of things. Angels here. And the word angel, by the way, means messenger, one who brings a message from God. And so the angel brought this message. And the first part of the message is actually for Paul. And the angel said, do not be afraid. Do you think Paul was afraid? If he's human, he's made of the same stuff as you and me. He was afraid. He says so in, you know, that God is actually in 2 Corinthians 1. He says, God put me into some terrible situations. Why? So that I would learn to rely on him. Fear is okay. And Paul was afraid, so the angel showed that God cared. Don't be afraid. Doesn't that show God cares? So that's the care one. Then he says, "You, Paul, don't be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar." What does that assume? What does that say? You must stand before Caesar. Who's in control? God's in control. You are going to stand before, you must stand before Caesar. God's in control. Does God have a purpose? Yes, for Paul to stand before Caesar. He covers those three questions in very short space, doesn't he? Don't be afraid. You must stand before Caesar. He addresses Paul's need, and then he goes on to meet the people's needs. So he says, "Don't be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar, and behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you." What do you think that implies? He has granted you. He must have asked. Paul must have said, "Lord, save everybody." And there was that's what it implies, that Paul had been asking that the Lord would save them. The Lord has granted that to you. And they're all going to be saved. So now the passengers have a promise from God. And so now Paul tries to apply it to them. Verse 25, "So take heart, men." And this is the key verse of the whole passage. If you don't get anything else, get this. "So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told." Exactly. "But we must run aground on some island." Now, why did Paul have that faith that it would be exactly? Just because he'd seen the vision? If it was somebody other than Paul who hadn't had Paul's experience, they wouldn't know how to interpret the vision. "I just had this vision." Whether they really believed it and could say like Paul, it will happen exact. "I have faith in God and it will be exactly as I've been told." Paul had some background. Did he know his scriptures? He knew his scriptures. Let me give you a couple messy situations in the Old Testament he would have known. David with King Saul. Do you remember David and King Saul? King Saul was out to kill David. And Jonathan actually came to David, and it says Jonathan strengthened his hand in the Lord. That's what counseling is supposed to be, a person's hand being strengthened in the Lord. So Jonathan comes and strengthens David's hand in the Lord. God cares. God's in control, and God will keep his promise to you, David. You're going to be the king one day. He will fulfill his purpose in this messy situation. Another messy situation. David's got, he comes from back from raiding. He's still not king yet, but he lands at Ziklag, comes back home, and the Amalekites have visited. Now, when Amalekites visit, they burn everything and take everybody with them. So when David got back, back home and sees, and all his men, they just bawled their eyes out. What a mess. And the men were planning on stoning him. And what does it say? It says, David strengthened himself in the Lord. He knew God cared, he knew God was in control, and God had a purpose. Didn't know what those were, the purpose was, but then he asked, "Lord, shall I go and chase him?" "Yeah, go for it. You'll catch him." And he did. So Paul knew those stories, didn't he? And then what about for himself? He'd seen the Lord promise him a tough time and God completely to the last letter fulfill what was going to happen, including the bit about the buckle, his belt being tied around and being carried by and delivered over from the Jews to the Gentiles. It happened exactly. So Paul knew from both scripture and experience. So he could say, "I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told." All right. Well, our narrative continues. Verse 27. "When the 14th night had come, as we were being driven along the across the Adriatic Sea, which, sort of part, which is part of the Mediterranean, closer to Italy and Greece. About midnight, the sailors suspected they were nearing land. Could possibly hear the waves crashing against the rocks. So they took a sounding and found it was 20 fathoms, about 40 metres that is, 40 metres deep. And a little further, they found it was 30 metres deep. It's getting shallower. We're approaching some land. So they threw out anchors. Now, instead of throwing it from the front, they threw it out from the back, the stern of the ship, so that the wind would be blowing them in the right direction. So when they released the anchors, they would be heading in the right direction. They wouldn't have to turn the ship around. Follow that? So tension's getting pretty high now. And the sailors figure, well, this lot, let's just look after ourselves. What do the sailors do? Verse 30, and as the sailors were seeking to escape, they figured at least they'll save their own skins. Isn't that like human beings? At least they'll save me. That's how panicky they get. We're caring for anybody else? Nah. We'll leave this lot to die. We'll just get ourselves. And so they were lowering down the ship, pretending. Now, Paul's pretty sharp. He sees what's going on. And he says in verse 31 to the centurion and the soldiers, and now he helps the centurion and the soldiers to see their lives are on the line. Unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. Right. It made short work of the ropes. Off goes the boat. Well, that's a bit sad, really, because it might have been helpful to help get to land. But now there's not even a boat. How's God going to pull off everybody getting aboard, getting onto land? Verse 33, as the day was about to dawn, Paul urged them to take some food. He's practical, isn't he? Get some food into you. God's going to keep you. You're going to need the food to help you get through. They were encouraged, and once they'd eaten, they tossed the rest overboard. Get the ship a bit lighter. Why do they want the ship lighter? Doesn't sink so far into the ocean. Get closer into shore. Verse 39, now when it was day, they didn't recognize the land, but they noticed the bay on which they could plan to run the ship. So they cast off the anchors, left them in the sea, and at the same time loosening the rudders and tied the rudder. And hoisting a little bit of sail, they made for shore. Now this is when it gets really messy. Striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground. The bow stuck and remained immovable, and the stern was being broken up by the surf. Do you imagine the confusion? The terror? This thing, boat being smashed? And at the same time, the soldiers are looking after their own skin. If our prisoners escape, what will happen to us? So we better the prisoners. You think if it wasn't complicated enough. But the centurion, wishing to save Paul in verse 43, kept them from carrying out their plan to kill the soldiers. So, the prisoners, rather. So the centurion ordered that they should, those who could swim, go first, and the rest grab something to float on and make for shore. It's a very short sentence, the last one, isn't it? And so it was that all were brought safely to land. In all that turmoil, in all that rushing of waves, do you think maybe just one, 275 would have been a pretty good call, wouldn't it? No, we only lost one. Paul said, it will be exactly as I've been told. That's how sovereign God is. You've got to know God's sovereign. See, when Philip was in hospital, he's lost a leg, he's got secondaries coming. You've got to know. I've got to know. And I'm so glad God helped me to see his sovereignty before all that happened. We have to know God is sovereign. He is in control. Chapter 28. After we were brought safely through, we then learned that the island was called Malta. Now, Malta, how big do you think it is compared to Tasmania? Tasmania is huge. 300K. Malta, 15K by 25K. And they were coming at the 15K end. All right? There's an awful lot of ocean. There's 400 miles between Malta, Sicily there, down to the quicksands. And all the coast along here that they could have been. So where did they happen to get blown to? Just happen. They didn't know where they were. Is God sovereign or what? You've got this little boat totally helpless, and God plants it right on Malta. Well, the native people showed unusual kindness. They kindled a fire and welcomed it. So it was cold. They were looking after him. All the danger is past, right? No. You think his servant Paul out, you know, helping, he's not too full of his own ego to go out and help collect wood. And he gets bitten and has this snake. It doesn't let go. It's just dangling, you know. And not long enough for people. It wasn't a quick zap. It was hanging there. Long enough for people to say, oh, boy, you must have been bad. You escaped that, but you're not going to escape this one. Isn't it interesting when you have a correct view of who's actually in control? See, the natives figured out he must be some sort of god. Were they right? No, he's just a man. When Paul looked at it, what did he know? I'm going to get to Rome. So can God? Is this going to stop God? Not at all. He can control the venom. He can control all that sort of stuff. He'd done it before in the Old Testament when they raised the bronze pole and the people had been bitten by snakes. He'd done it before. So he did it for Paul this time. Isn't a right view of things important? Knowing God is in control. It's so important. Now, are there any beneficiaries of all this? Well, as a matter of fact, there are. And you wouldn't have picked it, would you? But here they are. There's those on the island of Malta. Publius's dad, sick in bed. Paul heals him. Wind of that gets around very quickly. And you got the whole island comes and gets healed. Do you know they actually date the Christian heritage of Malta back to the time when Paul landed? Looked it up on computer. Not very good at that, but that's their tradition. They can date back their Christianity to when. Now, it doesn't mention that in the text because that's not what Paul wants to bring out. He wants to bring out God's in control. God cares. And God does have a purpose, even in the trials that are just so messy. So what about us? In conclusion, we face the same three questions, don't we? Is he in control? I've got a friend who said, God, he was sovereign back then, but not now. No, God is sovereign now. Jesus Christ the same yesterday and today and forever. He tried to teach his disciples. Jesus taught his disciples, not a sparrow will fall to the ground. Is God sovereign? If a sparrow can't fall to the ground unless the Father says so. Even the hairs of your head are all numbered. The Lord is in control. And does he care? Well, Romans 8:32 says, he who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, will he not also give us all things with him? If he gave his son, he cares for us. And you know, other ones like, cast all your anxieties on him, for he cares for you. And does he have a purpose? Well, please don't make Job's friend error in coming up with glib answers for those who are suffering. Because all they need right then, while they're going through the suffering, is knowing that you care. people come and say, oh, it's all God's sovereign, isn't it wonderful? Yeah, well, your son's dying. It's not real good counsel. But know it before you get to it, that God is sovereign, that he cares, and that he does have a purpose for it. So there are no glib answers on the why, but there are plenty of answers in Scripture. God's glory. You see, he's going to allow us to go through testing to see if we'll trust him. That's what happened to Job. Will he still trust me when I give him a take everything away? God's glory is at stake. And ours, when we suffer. It says in Peter, you read Peter, if we're going to have glory, we have to go through suffering too. A football team doesn't go out there and play an easy game and have glory at the end unless they suffer. They've got to be real. That's the nature of the life God's given us. And the one in Scripture that we've already heard earlier in Romans 8:28, we know that in everything God works for good with those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. And what's his purpose? It's actually to make, and it says in verse 29, to make you and me more like his son. That's what he's working on in all the different struggles and challenges we face. Now, we may not like his method. God doesn't expect us to like it. We don't have to like the way the Lord does things. But we should know in Isaiah 55, it says, remember this. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, and your ways are not my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than yours. Let's pray.